If you do not have a validated tap card, you may be subject to penalties.
It's not Compton, what's up, punk? It's South Central, a crime wave of gangster made criminals.
South Central Los Angeles, in mainstream media and in the minds of those who don't work or live here, is often branded by the violent and chaotic flashpoints in its history.
South Central Rooted will demonstrate that these events were culminations of the generations of institutional neglect and exploitation that precedes them. Although some of the conditions changed, this legacy still affects South LA residents in all aspects of their daily lives, from housing and employment to transportation, policing, and the environment.
Yeah, we don't want to do anything to scare your children. That's the last thing we want to do.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. My name is Elmer Roldan, and I'm one of your co-hosts for this podcast, South Central Rooted. The residents of South Los Angeles are often faced with housing instability due to increasing rates of gentrification and displacement. We know housing is just exorbitant these days, and so is rent. But in South Los Angeles in particular, housing instability is rooted in a long-living legacy of exclusion and segregation of, in particular, Black and Latino residents. Unfortunately, the pandemic has exacerbated these issues, especially among low-income renters who might have experienced job loss or severe health problems tied to the pandemic. Displacement of residents not only disrupts their social ties and social networks, but they are also at risk of becoming homeless because of housing instability. Overall, housing conditions and the instability that I mentioned continue to negatively impact the health and well-being of South LA residents. What we've done here today is we've invited three community leaders to join our panel discussion to shed light on these issues that we're talking about here today that contribute to the ongoing housing instability and crisis that we're facing in South Los Angeles. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to welcome our panelists for today. First, we are joined by Rabia Sen of the Esperanza Community Housing. Welcome and thank you for being here with us. We also have Araceli Amezquita from SAGE. We also are happy to have Oscar Monge from Trust South LA. So I'm gonna go ahead and start with the question to our first panelist. So why don't we start with Rabia? And I will ask you this question. Why were most Black and Latino residents in South LA unable to purchase their own homes? And what policies over the years have prevented these families from accumulating or transferring wealth from one generation to the next?
I think this question, you know, about why so many Black and Latino residents in South LA have been unable to purchase their own homes really goes back to this country's history of anti-Black racism and how that has actually played into and shaped so many of our policies, economic policy, housing policy, and land use policy. Most folks are aware of this country's history, especially when it comes to economic and land use policy around redlining, which really was used to restrict people's access to resources, especially capital, that they could use to purchase property. And that actually has played a huge role. And being that it was actually based on racial stereotypes, that means, therefore, in places such as South LA, that Black and brown residents were and historically have been unable to purchase their own homes without jumping through God knows how many barriers and how many loopholes to get there. This history of redlining and this history of racist land use and zoning that has happened in the US and particularly here in LA, since we're talking about LA, really has contributed to that inequity and has contributed to increasing health disparities that we are seeing in low-income communities, especially in Black and brown communities.
Yes. If you can pinpoint specific policies that have prevented families from accumulating or transferring wealth from one generation to the next?
The first part that I spoke about was actually redlining policies themselves, right? So that was used by the housing industry, by mortgage companies in particular, to suppress BIPOC folks from receiving home loans in order to buy homes in their neighborhoods. As well as even if they owned their own home, it restricted their ability from accessing capital and loans to improve their homes, right? To make those improvements on their homes. So that's one piece. I think the other piece has also been the land use policies that have happened. So when you look at South LA and you look at the history of land use in South LA, several things really come to mind for me. And other than restricting people from being able to purchase their own homes, it also continued to create an environment that was harmful to the health of Angelenos living in South LA. And it also contributed to factors that then forced the displacement of Angelenos who have lived in South LA for generations. So when you're looking at these types of policies, for example, you saw the land use and zoning policies that happened from the 50s and well into the 60s that basically created LA's famous freeway system. But that freeway system didn't come without a price. And it is our communities, including the South LA communities, who were treated as the sacrifice zones. So you had the freeways that basically bifurcated the communities of South LA as well as East LA. And you have those types of decisions continuing to happen, whether it is where these freeways go through, whether it has to do with the history of redlining and racist zoning policies that also include the fact that zoning policies have allowed a disproportionate number of harmful industrial uses to happen in these very neighborhoods as well. So it's a lot of this that has contributed to that type of disenfranchisement. The other piece of that then happens is you have investment or quote unquote investment happening now in these neighborhoods. And it has been happening over the last few decades. And it's basically been sold as this whole thing about we've disinvested from these communities in the past, we're going to invest back in them. But the question is how those investments happen and for whom those investments happen. And very often the investments are based on a market-based capitalist approach of making profit. You see these types of policies that are then put in there that are quote unquote about economic development. But the question is, who is the development for? So for example, when you had the 84 Olympics come through in South LA, it was sold as this huge investment, not just in the city, but specifically in South LA. But when you look at the types of investments that were made without an eye to equity and without a focus on who was already in the community and who'd be impacted, who would be displaced, who would benefit from it. The fact is that when displacement happened, it happened to people, to residents of the South LA communities. They were the ones being displaced. They were the ones being policed out of their homes and their neighborhoods. That is what came out of the 84 Olympics, for example, as you go through, and then you go through to the LA uprising in the 90s, which was basically something that was just ready to happen. It was a perfect storm of events because of the types of disinvestment that had happened and then the types of investment that had happened that was not centering the communities most impacted. Then as you move forward a bit more, you start seeing people saying, oh, well, we need to create more housing here and that will help. But the fact is that the housing policies themselves were extremely flawed because the idea was that you just build and you rely on the market to actually make sure that this then becomes affordable housing. We know that trickle-down economics has never worked. And we know that it has never worked, especially for Black and Brown communities. It was never meant to work that way. It was just meant to go to the highest bidder. And when you already have a community that has faced decades and decades of policies, including redlining policies that have disenfranchised and basically drained resources and capital from this community, that type of approach isn't going to happen. So when you have then following the LA uprisings and moving forward into the 90s, into the noughts, and even now, when you have this type of investment happening to just build housing that is market rate housing, essentially what you're doing is you're bringing in luxury housing, you're pricing out current residents, and you're creating displacement, not just direct displacement, right, of residents who have been evicted from their homes in order to make way for this housing. But you also have the indirect displacement of residents within a 1 mile, within a 2 mile radius of the luxury housing who are still victims of the rising rents and that type of ripple effect that then happens.
Yeah. I'm going to ask Araceli and Oscar to jump in here as well, and we'll come back to you in just a second, because this is such a rich conversation. And so I want to make sure that we, you know, also touch on other questions that we have. You know, Araceli and Oscar, if, you know, I want to invite either one of you to jump in and share more to this point that Rabia lifted about the government sanctioning and enforcing segregation. And she mentioned the freeways in particular, which we know is such a staple of Los Angeles, but to think that so many people were displaced in order for us to build these freeways that define communities. But can either one of you talk about this government sanction, segregation and enforcement, and in particular, how it has disproportionately impacted Black and Brown communities? Araceli, I'll start with you.
Thank you, Rabia, for sharing all that information. I think you pretty much captured everything that the question was asking. But I do think that with the government sanctions with building the freeways in communities of color is a way to take advantage of the fact that people of color are living in those areas. And what comes to mind is the environment toxicity that is created for those communities that live there. So, it's very unfortunate to think back into history and hear that the government was creating these freeways, even though it's such an advantage for the rest of the city, but for the people that live in those areas, it's a disadvantage. And it is something that causes a lot of harm to the people that live there in their healths. And I think it's very unfortunate, but it's a way to push people out of those communities into other areas. And you see the divide of the classism within that divide. It's like that saying, right? Like, I live on the other side of the tracks. So it kind of is that kind of perception of dividing people based on their class or their income. But yeah, I think Rabia pretty much touched a lot of great points in regards to that question. But that's my take on that in that sense for that question.
Thank you. Oscar, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yes, and thank you so much for the content, Rabia and Araceli. I think that one of the things that popped for me is that, I guess a kind of trigger for me is that it's like we have actions in our political and economic mechanisms that are overtly and covertly racist. And I think that, I guess you had a tricky question because it's like, you know, okay, we have to point out the racist policies that have excluded our communities from building ownership and wealth. And like, we can point at some, like the ones that Rabia pointed out, you know, like redlining, deed restrictions and covenants that California has had, which have excluded property ownership, folks that are of color, right? Like Black and Brown folks and others. But we also have practices in our communities, oh, including LSAC, like the one that Rabia just listed in the chat. But we also have like those other processes that, you know, like predatory lending that have taken advantage of our community's ability to really purchase properties because, you know, before like the last crisis in 08, 09, folks were being given loans without having the means to pay those loans back. And it was very irresponsible of the government to allow the private sector, the lending sector to be doing that. And what we have now is much rigorous process for how loans are given, but they've also in that way, I guess, become really hard for folks to achieve because pricing in the market is really terribly high. So I guess I hope that's making sense. Like there's like those overt racist policies like we see in history, right? Like redlining VA loans, right? Veterans loans after World War II that were easy for white folks to obtain, but not as easy for folks of color to, you know, get to be able to buy properties, accumulate wealth, and pass on to the next generation. And yeah, just those are things. And then to add to like the other piece, that the second piece of the question on, I guess, infrastructural development that's really benefiting the whole city, but causes impacts into the communities where those infrastructures are set in place. I'm thinking about how eminent domain has been used in the past. Eminent domain as a tool to the government basically obtaining private land to construct development that is going to benefit the public and the society in general. But those have been examples of like freeways, like people were saying, and also schools and other utility like uses. But we haven't really used eminent domain to build affordable housing for our communities. And when anyone says eminent domain for affordable housing, it's like it's a trigger word and no one wants to really work towards that. So I think it's really interesting how some of these tools have impacted our communities, but they can't be used for a positive outlook in our communities. Just wanted to add those things. So thank you.
Thank you for that. And Rabia, I'd love for you to tell us more about the Ellis Act.
So the Ellis Act, it's a state law passed in the 80s that actually allows landlords to evict their residential tenants in order to go out of business, or as they say, go out of the rental business. Oftentimes that Ellis Act has been used to evict tenants, especially in low-income housing, to evict them and then somehow it goes back on the market at a much higher rental rate, or it's then converted into luxury housing, such as condos, things like that. So that has historically been used against low-income renters. And let's not kid ourselves, in the city of LA, a majority renter city, and also, you know, with Black and Brown communities who often bear a disproportionate burden of these impacts, this is definitely what impacts them. Their ability to stay housed, even in rental housing, forget being able to accumulate enough resources and capital and to be able to secure a loan in order to purchase their own home. Our communities are struggling to even stay in their rental housing. And this is pre-pandemic. We're not even talking about what's happening during the pandemic. What we're seeing in Los Angeles, what is happening to BIPOC communities in Los Angeles when it comes to housing, when it comes to displacement and the loss of housing and housing instability, what we're seeing is we are seeing a history of exclusionary policies, practices, and systems that have been based along racial lines and have created the segregated landscape that we see today in Los Angeles. And so I did start with the historical context of redlining policies, of zoning policies with the freeways, with industrial land use. And it's important to note that because those have not been addressed. Let's be clear, those have not been addressed. A lot of those practices are still on the books today, on top of which we have then had compounding policies and practices that have come into play, including investment that is not equitable, including the Ellis Act, and including all these other market rate forces that drive displacement and gentrification of the very communities that we should actually be centering at any point, and especially during this pandemic, if we're going to ensure racial equity, racial justice, and a just recovery moving forward.
I'm going to go ahead and move the conversation along to talk about post-recession. So we know that from 2007 to roughly 2011, the housing crisis swept through the nation and left many without a home. You know, in South Los Angeles, in particular, this community was impacted deeply by the foreclosures and the depreciated housing values. We know that private equity firms stepped in and commercial investors stepped in and scooped up the land. Many of these distressed properties, Blackstone Group is an example of one of these businesses who accumulated mass amounts of land that then these private firms and commercial investors, you know, went back and, you know, and either made crazy profits from reselling the properties at a much higher cost, or in some cases even rented the same homes back to the people who they had taken the homes from. And this is where the Ellis Act aligns with these time period. So I want to ask Araceli, why don't you start us off on this section here? And, you know, I'd love for you to share how it is that private equity firms became interested in neighborhoods like South Los Angeles, you know, and if there's any foresight into how they plan to make profits from communities like South Los Angeles, and specifically from whom? Who are they? Who is their target market?
Like you mentioned, the housing crisis, the foreclosures, where people lost their homes due to the nature of not being able to make those payments to pay off the homes. That was definitely like an open door for these private entities to come in and take over and demolish and create housing at a higher market rate. And that's kind of like what Rabia mentioned with Ellis. The Ellis Act is like with the Rental Stabilization Ordinance, the RSO buildings, there was a lot of homes and apartment buildings that are being demolished or taken out of the rental market, and luxury apartment homes or apartment housing is created at a much higher rate. And South LA, South Central LA is a target because we do see that there's a large low-income community, and the property market out here is less than other areas of LA. So it's a perfect target for private entities to come out here and buy this land. It has a lot to do with the fact that private entities do come out here because they see the opportunity to be able to buy like the land that's not as expensive as areas such as Beverly Hills or popular places like Highland Park or other areas like Boyle Heights. So South LA is very vulnerable to private entities when it comes down to the value of the land. So I believe that's the reason why we see that happening a lot here in South LA.
Thank you. I live on Slauson and Broadway, and I regularly have folks sending me text messages or calling me, offering me cash for my property. And for anybody that knows, this area is lacking in serious investment. I mean, it's hard to get groceries around here or, you know, or healthy food. Yet the fact that there is so much energy being placed behind buying the homes in this community just really tells you a lot about what's to come in the next 5 to 10 years here. Oscar, I'm going to throw it to you. I have a question that I think a lot of folks are interested in talking about, and that is how corporations have stepped into the rental market. And when it's large groups like, you know, that have huge amounts of capital controlling the rental business, and how, you know, just what that does to housing instability for South Los Angeles.
Just to back up, something that I thought about when you asked the first question was an article that I read a couple of years ago about how South LA is like a fool's minefield almost. And it's like one of the painting the picture that everyone should be going to South LA to purchase their properties because it's like there's gold to be made. There's profits to be made in one of the last remaining quote unquote affordable areas to buy land and homes. And so it makes you feel like something really weird, you know, like it's a very weird feeling to have like an area being marketed in that way when you know community members and when you know families that are struggling to be able to afford to stay in one of the quote unquote last remaining affordable areas. Even though it's affordable, there's still facing a lot of challenges being able to, I mean, this is before the pandemic, being able to stay in their communities, raised the Ellis Act, Ellis evictions in the area, having harassment from landlords who are more, I guess, to answer this question on the corporate mindset. We've seen our members, you know, come to us and share, like in the last two, you know, we had a really great landlord, but they unfortunately had to sell. And when they sold it to a larger corporation. And that's when they start seeing the differences in their buildings, where the landlord is starting to offer them, you know, money to leave their buildings or pressure them out, even though they have rent control protections. And they start, you know, renovating and making improvements on their apartments and making them healthier to live in, which is everyone should have that, right? But the next thing that comes after that is folks experiencing evictions, and then those folks having to move farther away from where they have lived for decades, where folks are moving, like, you know, like into past the Florences, right? Because the farther south you go, the more quote unquote affordable it is. But folks start to lose, like, those connections to where to their communities, and also those amenities that you referenced, right? Like, there's a lack of amenities like food and other services. So I think to your question, corporations, they don't care about who lives in the community. What they care about is how they're gonna, you know, make more money, how they're gonna have other people in the community and sell it for them, you know, to build their profit. I don't have any more responses to that, but I guess I would love to talk about why our work is so important in the community as a community land trust. Trust South LA is centered in acquiring existing housing, unsubsidized affordable housing, stabilizing families in our community. And in this process, we have seen a lot of the obstacles of trying to acquire these properties, and we're competing with others who are, you know, able to buy a property in, like, closed, you know, escrow accounts in like less than 30 days because they have organized resources. And it is just unbelievable to see that, you know, we've done some research, and in like the last 10 years, there's been over an 82% increase in prices. Or just but to have like numbers in our minds, units that cost about $150,000 per unit when you're thinking about buying a property, they're now costing closer to $300,000 to $350,000 per unit. So it's almost double the price. And they're doing this at the, you know, in the backs of the community, right? Their plan after selling these buildings is that the future landlords are going to evict and they're going to make more money. They're going to recuperate that investment, which is just I'll end my comment there, but it's just, I guess, just a lot of challenges that we're experiencing and we're seeing.
Ravi, I'd love for you to pick it up on this topic. You can speak to how Wall Street firms like the Blackstone Group operate in South Los Angeles. And is it similar or is it different than how they operate in other neighborhoods like South Los Angeles across the country?
Speaking of Wall Street firms, and you've named Blackstone a few times, I think they're a great example of what we're seeing here, right? Corporate landlords such as Blackstone basically come into these neighborhoods. They buy up thousands of foreclosed homes. And, you know, Aris Ali spoke to that, as did Oscar. And they turn them into luxury housing, mostly for rental. And this is what they're doing. And this is how they're functioning in places such as South LA. They are looking solely for their own profit. They are not bound by any rules unless the jurisdictions themselves actually enact meaningful value capture programs, whether it's a city or the county of LA or both. They're basically operating however they wish to increase their profits. And in order to do that, it is actually in their interests to make a profit. It is in their interests to displace low-income families so that they can then foreclose on those homes, foreclose on those buildings, and turn them into luxury housing. In fact, in terms of Blackstone, since you brought that up, I just wanted to point out that in 2019, the UN actually accused the Blackstone Group of contributing to the global housing crisis. So these Wall Street practices that we're talking about that are showing up in South LA are the same practices that are showing up in the rest of this country and throughout the world that are actually creating the housing crisis. And to be clear, when we say there's a housing crisis, it's not simply a lack of housing. It's a lack of healthy and affordable housing. And when you're looking at what Wall Street and corporate landlords are doing in places like South Central, they are demolishing affordable housing units in order to build luxury housing units. That in and of itself should tell you the full picture. One other piece that I also wanted to point out, while we're talking about corporate landlords and Wall Street, I just wanted to quickly name the 2017 tax bill that the GOP passed. And a key part of that tax bill that was passed by the Republicans is actually something called an opportunity zone. That's basically just another vehicle by which corporate landlords are able to come into these neighborhoods. What the opportunity zone does, it basically is a designation that is applied to census tracts that allows investments in these tracts to be significantly protected from taxation. More importantly, what it also does, so the governor of each state basically identifies what census tracts would be eligible to be designated as opportunity zones. In California, in order to be designated as an opportunity zone, eligible census tracts had to be considered low income with a median income of less than 80% of the region's average or a poverty rate above 20%. So basically that would apply to areas such as South Central. And so once these areas have been designated as opportunity zones, then people can come in and invest in that community and get tax breaks. The problem with this is that there are no checks or balances and no guidance towards equity in how that money and that investment will be used. It basically, therefore, just becomes another tax shelter for people, for the wealthy. It becomes another tax shelter for Wall Street to continue making its profits. And what I also just want to point out about opportunity zones is that the majority of the investments thus far that we have seen in Los Angeles, as well as in other areas in the US, have had to do with real estate development. So when you combine that with the already racist zoning practices and the already harmful practices being put into place by corporate landlords such as Blackstone, you have just compounded and increased the rate at which gentrification and displacement is happening in communities that actually need more support and more investment to ensure that we preserve healthy, affordable housing, that we produce more healthy, affordable housing, and that we actually ensure that there are tenant protections in place to guard against evictions, to guard against the displacement that's happening, to guard against the fact that people are being priced out of their homes, left, right, and center by all these policies, economic and otherwise, that are being put in place.
Points that you were making right now about the connection between housing and health, it actually brings up our next topic, because I love to explore that. And we know that, you know, when communities are faced with housing inequality and unfair housing conditions, that leads to negative health conditions. And it's something that is very common in South Los Angeles, where residents have reported a number of issues impacting their health, from infrastructure issues in the homes that they live, like plumbing, heating, air conditioning, to more serious issues like mold or roofie leaks or pests and other vermin that attack their homes. And we know that this translates to health issues, including asthma and other respiratory conditions. The other thing that we know is becoming a more common issue that families are faced with is overcrowding and multiple family members crowding into small spaces, or in many cases, multiple families having to live in the same house in order for them to afford the exorbitant costs of housing in Los Angeles. And then, you know, connected to that is the multi-generational trauma that comes from all of these issues, as well as the displacement that we've been talking about here today. So, Robbie, I'm going to come back to you with this question. And, you know, I'd love for you to expand a little bit more on the health consequences that are, you know, adults and children face when housing is unstable and unaffordable, especially in communities like Los Angeles and South Los Angeles.
You covered so much of it in the context you provided for this question itself. The majority of renters in the city are rent burden. And in South LA, I forget the exact percentage. I think it's over 60, maybe close to 70% of renters in South LA are rent burden, which means that the majority of their paycheck on a monthly basis goes towards paying rent. Logically, what does this mean? This means that we have families in South LA who are living in poverty, who are living with the constant threat of becoming unhoused, having to make the difficult decision each month on where to spend their limited resources. Is it to be spent on keeping a roof over their heads by paying rent? Is it to be spent on food and healthy food, on transportation, on the means by which to get to work, to school, to access healthcare, to do so many other things? And the common factor between all these different needs is that they are basic human needs. So when you live in an area where almost 70% of people are rent burden and having on a daily basis to make this choice between which basic human need they are going to have to prioritize, that is a basic violation of anyone's human rights. This is why at Esperanza, and especially at the Unidad Coalition, of which all three of us, our organizations, are founding members of the Unidad Coalition, we always say that housing is a health and human right. So we don't just say we need housing, we say we need affordable and healthy housing. Because without that, without access to that, you have exactly the conditions that you just described, Elmer. You have families being forced into substandard housing conditions, basically into slum housing conditions. You have families being forced into overcrowding houses. You have more than one family living in a one bedroom because the rent is that high, because wages are so low, and because they are constantly having to make these choices. So when you have that, you are naturally going to see these health consequences. And this is part of what we talk about when we say that there are major health disparities, that when you analyze them, they do fall, you know, along certain lines. They do have racialized impacts. And that's what we see in South LA. So you see a higher incidence of asthma, whether it's pediatric asthma or it's adult onset of asthma. You have higher rates of heart disease. You have all of these. And it is not an issue that is based on the individual. It is an issue that is a result of systemic racism, a system that has created an unhealthy environment that compels families to live in overcrowded housing, in substandard housing, in slum housing areas. On top of which, I'm just going to add in, when we say housing is a health and human right issue, we are not just talking about the individual health of the people, of the adults and families living in that home. We are talking about community health. We are talking about environmental health, because the health outside is also has a direct impact, of course, on the residents of that community. And so earlier on, I think I had mentioned the zoning practices, right? So not just the redlining policies, but also the zoning practices that have disproportionately located in harmful industrial land uses right next to homes, schools, and parks in South LA and in other similar communities throughout LA. And when you look at these and you look at the harm to the environment that has happened and therefore to the community health that has happened, it's really difficult. And I think it's wrong to try and separate the two issues. One last thing I'm just going to name. When I talk about harmful industrial practices, the one that is foremost in my mind is the location of oil extraction facilities right next to homes, schools, and parks in South LA. There are so many of them. And at Esperanza Community Housing, we, alongside residents of our affordable housing buildings and other residents in the neighborhood, have fought for well over a decade around one specific site. This is just one of many in South LA. It was an oil extraction facility called Allen Co. that was conducting its business, being a bad neighbor and being there and conducting its business in bad faith, basically poisoning the community. And with that, what we saw is we heard from employees, residents, and residents of affordable housing buildings, how it was impacting their health and that of their children. There was an increase in the onset of pediatric and adult asthma. There was an increase in other respiratory illnesses. We had people, especially children, having nosebleeds. It wasn't just one small nosebleed. It was soaking through pillows. Parents were staying up at night to make sure that their children did not stop breathing. This is why we say that we need healthy, affordable housing. This is why we say that we need affordable housing so people are not having to choose between basic needs. We need a healthy environment that is devoid of these types of industrial extractive land uses that come along with an extractive economy, which includes our corporate landlords. We need policies and practices at the city level that are regenerative, that center the people who are most impacted by these practices, and that ensure then that we don't have families who are rent burdened and who are constantly living on the brink of becoming unhoused.
Wow, I had to take a deep breath as you were sharing all of this, because it truly is shocking. And often the headlines in the newspapers and the reports tell you that we are suffering, but what you just shared provides a lot of context as to what is causing all that suffering and trauma that our communities are experiencing. You just have to take a deep breath and absorb it, because it truly is heartbreaking when you provide the context for it. I'm going to ask, maybe Araceli, you can answer this question for us. And that is the psychological impact that comes from multiple episodes of displacement. There is a term that folks use, it's called root shock. And I'd love for you to talk more about how families are traumatized by displacement.
When families get displaced or bought out from their community, from their neighborhoods, from their homes, it does create a psychological effect in terms of, like, you know, you build a home, you grew up in that area, you grew up, you build a family, and all those memories, all those emotional attachments you have in that place get taken away. So there's a lot of mental health aspects that also come out of that, with the stress and worry, depression, anxiety. So we at Sage, we have a weekly tenant action clinic, and we do see a lot of community members come to our tenant action clinic and share their stories. And we do hear a lot of folks talk about the idea of building a home, growing up there, loving their community, and don't want to move out, but they have no other choice. And a lot of it has to do with a lot of the things that were mentioned earlier about healthy housing and neglect and the lack of repairs from the property owners or slumlords as well, because we do see a lot of slumlords in South LA where they neglect the properties and tenants have to live through, like, very unhabitable conditions. And the way we like to empower tenants and inform tenants about the way landlords perceive housing as opposed to tenants is that to them, it's a business. But for us as tenants, it's a home. And when we provide that perspective, we see the tenants kind of realize that landlords don't care. All they care is about getting paid every month without even paying attention to the conditions of the home. And even living in a home that's not habitable, it does cause a lot of emotional distress. It does cause a lot of mental health issues as well. And that's not the way that, you know, we want to see tenants living, especially in communities of low-income communities of color. I think that what we see at the Tenant Action Clinic with folks coming in, it's very impactful when we hear their stories of them being bought out through cash for keys and leaving their homes because they have no other choice. And that causes them to move farther out and travel farther out to work, you know. So there's a lot of things that come into play when it comes down to the impact of that shock of leaving and realizing that at the end of the day, the property owners are not their friends. They're just people that are expecting to get paid every month. And it's a service. But to us, to the community, is a home. So it's very impactful.
We have been talking about stuff that is heavy and that overwhelming because the multi-generational challenges and the amount of wealth that goes into displacing communities time and time again. But we want to end our podcast today with a sense of hope. And the reason why we invited the three of you on here is because we want to talk about communities coming together to defend the human indignity of our community. There's great inspiration behind the work that your organizations do. So I'd like for us to spend some time talking about how the pandemic has exacerbated inequities, particularly in housing insecurity. But I also would love for us to talk about what glimmers of hope exist in the current conditions. And, I'd love to start, Oscar, if you could kick us off about how the pandemic has elevated any opportunities to address the longstanding issues of housing instability and displacement in South Los Angeles.
These challenges that we've expressed during our conversation have been around, and we've been advocating to resolve these challenges for decades, right? And it's been frustrating yet rewarding to see that the government sector and the public sector has listened much more over the in light of the pandemic, and has actually, put in some effort to advance community ownership models that, like just recovery models that will flip that narrative of corporate ownership and flip it back to community ownership. And something that's really amazing to have seen is the growth of the community land trust work over the last, 12 to 15 months. We have community land trusts here in Los Angeles that have emerged throughout, areas in East LA, areas in El Sereno, throughout the Beverly, Vermont area. Also, the new COT community land trust in the Crenshaw area, Liberty Community Land Trust. Tres Ateliers here in the Maine and Vernon area, right on in Council District 9 area. And, you know, I guess out of this work, we've got the ears from the philanthropic world to put in some resources for all of our COTs to be able to have staffing, to have folks that are going to advance the work towards community ownership. They also saw that there could be an opportunity in our conversations with LA County. And just to share that last year in November, we were able to secure $14 million from the county to be able to acquire multifamily housing throughout the county, and you know, properties in each district to stabilize families. And we've been working with the supervisor district staff to come to an agreement of how we can have the community landlords own these properties and then convert those properties to tenant ownership. We've been advocating for this for decades, but it is probably the first, I mean, it is the first time in LA history that you see this amount of investments go towards community ownership. When you divide $14 million by five supervisor districts, putting like a very small Band-Aid on the issue, right? So we need more, but we're super excited that they're listening. You know, they put in some resources for the first pilot year. Another piece to also highlight is that in those conversations with the county and all that advocacy, they also are looking at creating a pilot project that will transfer property tax arrear properties to community land trusts so that they're not put in auctions. Some folks may know when property owners are not able to pay their property taxes or county property taxes, those properties get put in a list, and then those get auctioned off. And there's like auctions several times a year. The county there again, with the staff in the treasurer's department, is working with us to have a displacement aversion program so that those properties don't get auctioned off to higher bidding folks, but instead are transferred to community land trusts. So that's another amazing opportunity that's coming up in LA County for community land trust work in our COTs. And just to put on another amazing opportunity that we saw at the state level, and I was trying to look at the bill, but I couldn't find it. But basically, at the end of last year, the state passed a bill that they would have a first right to purchase for community land trust and folks that live on single family and small multifamily buildings to be able to purchase those buildings should the property owner have some sort of foreclosure on their loans. And that is an opportunity that is unheard of at this moment through this year, because that bill came without funding. We're actually doing state advocacy to have the state put an actual budget to support community landlords purchasing these buildings that are going to be foreclosed in. And so those are just a blurb of some opportunities that we've seen. And we're excited to continue working with the county and the city to, again, transition to flip the narrative that, you know, unlike the last recession, a lot of the housing went from family ownership right of buildings to corporate ownership. During this recession, we've learned from the past and tried to do advocacy to make sure that those properties go from corporate ownership to community ownership, to having community land trust, social housing initiatives, and other alternative home ownership models that can be implemented, and just, you know, repaint the narrative, right? Just trying to avoid the last recessions, lessons from the last recessions.
Thank you. Araceli, I'm going to ask you the next question about a term that folks use sometimes called disaster capitalism or pandemic profiteering. And if you can talk about ways that folks can stand up against those practices and in particular defend communities like South Los Angeles from falling victim to those practices.
The things that community members need to do is organize, get informed and organized, and be aware of what the outcomes of disaster capitalism, what that entails, right? Especially right now with what's happening with COVID-19 and the pandemic. And, you know, there's a lot of tenants living in fear of losing their homes. So it kind of goes back the concept of, you know, having private entities coming into communities like South Central and buying off these homes and evicting folks from their apartments and their homes. That's a form of disaster capitalism. And in order to have the community prevent that, get ready, prepare themselves and inform themselves, reach out to organizations that are involved in housing and tenant rights in order to get that information and build those leadership skills and talk to the community. I think a lot of folks have that to light the fire under their feet, to create solidarity and unity amongst their neighbors and their communities in order to, you know, get together and build a strong force to protect their communities, protect their homes, and also push for stronger tenant protections at the moment. Because I know with the SB 91, which is an extension to AB 3088 for the current tenant protections, even though it's a step forward, it's not perfect. There's a lot of loopholes that need to get fixed. We need folks to get active and proactive and talk to people that know about these laws or policies and are involved in this work in order for them to take action themselves for their community. What is needed from the community is to take the initiative to reach out to organizations to learn more about what they can do and become a leader in their community. And it all starts with talking, you know, reaching out and talking to your neighbors. And like I said, creating that unity and solidarity.
Thank you for that. I know that over the holidays and leading up to the holidays, there was two major actions that took place, one in Oakland and one here in Los Angeles with, it was primarily a group of mothers that had squatted in homes that had been left vacant and in protest demanded that those homes be turned over to residents who needed the housing. Although those are more extreme cases of organizing, they certainly elevate to the forefront the challenges that families are facing because of the housing crisis. So, yeah, before we transition to our next question, Araceli, any thoughts that you have on those actions by those groups, the Caltrans Homes and El Sereno, you know, and other actions similar to that, you know, to take more sort of in-your-face organizing to call out the housing inequality that exists in our country today?
It's an amazing and very courageous act to do that. The thing that comes to mind when I think about the Oakland moms and what's happening in El Sereno is that folks are starting to see it, you know, folks are starting to see that there's all these vacant properties, vacant units in luxury apartment houses, housing apartments, and no one's living there. It's just taking up space. Yet there's a lot of folks that are homeless, a lot of folks that are struggling to find homes where to live. So I think it's a very courageous act to finally have people take action and prove to the people in power that people need homes. Well, everything is rooted in capitalism, right? Everything is about money, making money. So we have to start seeing it from a different perspective of like, if that unit is vacant, if that home is vacant, then it should go to someone that needs it. It's money. It's always been money over humanity. And we need to switch that narrative around because there's a lot of space. There's a lot of property in Los Angeles. And I'm sure they're going to continue to build more luxury apartment housing, more properties, more homes where people cannot afford to live there. Yet there's still people in need of homes. So I hope that folks start to realize that and start to take action into occupying these homes that are not occupied.
I'm going to ask the listeners to all take out a pen and paper now, because I'm going to ask for the group to share some insight and resources. I want to start with you, Rabia, and I'd love for you to share any housing security rights that South LA residents may not know about that they should keep readily available in case they do need to, you know, benefit from, you know, having that knowledge at hand.
I would suggest is having phone numbers at hand, probably for all three of our organizations. And the reason I say this, for example, Esperanza, along with SAGE, we have our Healthy Homes program, and it's a partnership. Our community health promoters at Esperanza actually connect directly with residents to address issues having to do with their health. And more often than not, it is related to their housing situation. And SAGE, as Araceli had mentioned, they have the Tenant Rights Clinic. So we work in partnership with one another to jointly advocate with residents for their rights, for their health, and for their housing. So I think that is a very important piece to keep in mind. And maybe Araceli can speak more to this. They also launched their Own It website, SAGE did, last year to track different developments that are going to be coming into the area. And I think Oscar probably has a bit more here as well. So I'll stop here for now and just turn it over to them to speak more about.
Yeah, thanks, Rabia. Yeah, the Own It tool is something that we use for our Tenant Action Clinic to identify properties that are being developed and also learn more about the property that the tenant is living in, and identify organizing opportunities. And one other thing that we do get a lot through our Tenant Action Clinic is when the tenants do not know their landlord, they don't know the property owner. So that's also a great tool to find that out. So Own It, it's very effective. It's very easy to use, but I think it's also a great way to understand the pockets of developments in the city of LA. And one thing that I would do wanted to share as well is for folks that are facing or receiving eviction letters at the moment during the pandemic, they could contact stayhousedla.org and they can get connected to a legal service provider to assist them with their eviction notices. If there's any issues or tenant rights issues, they could also contact us to provide assistance through our Tenant Action Clinic hotline. We're doing everything virtually and over the phone. Our phone number is 213-745-9961. They could call us there, or they could tune in during our weekly Facebook Lives on Wednesdays at 11 in English and 12:30 in Spanish. And I'll pass it over to Oscar.
Those are amazing resources. And I guess the only two things that I want to share is that there was a recent bill called SB91, and there's a program that was developed called the California Emergency Rental Assistance Program. And from what it looks like, this came from the stimulus package from the last one. And there's about $2.6 billion designated for California, specifically to support with rent relief to tenants that are low income. So I think that folks should keep an eye out for that because the program should be launching very soon. I think it says that program will start accepting applications by mid-March. So that's, again, I know that, you know, a lot of tenants are specifically experiencing job losses and other economic challenges. So this is a good program to keep an eye out for. And then just more locally for Trust LA, we also do have our weekly meals distribution program. And I believe last year, we probably provided food to about 1,500 families. We do this on Mondays and Thursdays starting at noon. But you can also check out our website and our Facebook and Instagram for Trust LA to find out like when there's updates on that. And I'll kick it back to Elmer.
Yes, thank you for that. Great list. And we are going to close now. But before I do, I am going to come back to each one of you to tell me and tell the listeners one a book or one reading resource that they can pick up if they want to learn more about housing in the United States, how government contributed to the sanctioning of segregation and enforcement. I mean, there's just so much to unpack that you all shared with us today. And if you, like I said, you have a reading that you would recommend to our listeners who may be new to this topic or who may want to sharpen their knowledge about this issue and want to become more educated, how about we start with Araceli? How about you give us your recommendation for this group?
I have a lot in mind for recommendations of books, but one that stands out the most, because we definitely need to highlight disaster capitalism, especially right now with the current situation with COVID and the pandemic. We want to think long-term, right? We want to know what's going to happen after the pandemic is over, when the current tenant protections are lifted, and just to have folks kind of get some insight on how everything is related to, you know, natural disasters, pandemics, and how that impacts folks in the long run. I do have a book that I really admire, is The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein. And it talks about that precisely, about how there are certain events that shock the community and the impact that it has on their community, and how in the long run it affects their livability and their freedom, and how it connects back to disaster capitalism. And it kind of touches a little bit on the situation that happened with Katrina. And I think that's relevant to what's happening now, but not in a natural disaster way, but more so in a health way. So that's where my recommendation is, The Shock Doctrine.
Thank you. Oscar, how about
I have two, and the first one is called Resisting Development, Redevelopment, Protest in Aspiring Global Cities by Eleonora Pasotti. And this book specifically got it because it has a chapter on Tristan Delay's work and L.A. Kant's work here in Los Angeles, talking about specifically for Tristan Delay's Roland Curtis Gardens development and storyline. So I think it's a great book to kind of deepen a little bit more on like how Tristan Delay was able to acquire and work with the tenants to fight off a multi-billionaire investor, Roland Curtis Gardens, and then redevelop it into a larger building. So again, that's a Resisting Redevelopment, Protest in Aspiring Global Cities by Eleonora Pasotti, and I can also share her link for it. The other book is called On Common Ground, International Perspectives on the Community Land Trust by John Davis, Maria Hernandez Dorales, and Lynn Agoit. And this book, I specifically enjoy it because it has stories from all over the world and a couple here in the United States of different strategies that communities are organizing to reclaim and take back ownership of their communities. And there's some amazing chapters. I think one of them is also in Spanish. And the authors also made audio recordings that could be checked out in their websites. I can also check out, send you the links for those for folks to check out later.
Excellent. And Rabia, you can share your reading recommendations now.
I also had two. The first one, it's called Evicted, and it's by Matthew Desmond. It basically follows, I think, 8 families around Milwaukee who are struggling to pay rent to their landlords. And it's during the financial crisis of 07-08. It lays out exactly what it means to be rent burdened for Black and Brown communities and what they face. So I think that's really important. And the second book that I would actually recommend is Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which is, you know, really looking at mass incarceration and challenges all of us to look at this country's history around civil rights and racial justice, but also challenges us to really think critically about what we think we've achieved so far and what more we need, really challenging the anti-Black racism that has shaped so much of this country. And I think this book is especially important to read because so much around mass incarceration, around the criminal justice system, around policing is actually used in these very communities that we've been talking about to further disenfranchise the communities and advantage the very forces that drive gentrification and displacement. So yeah, this is what I would recommend.
Thank you all so much. These are great recommendations. I'll throw in my pick, The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein, which documents how the US government has contributed to segregation and systemic dehousing of people and ensuring that folks of color, in particular, Black families, remain unhoused and unable to build generational wealth. I want to thank our panelists today for coming here and dropping gems on all of us, for sharing your wisdom, your knowledge, your expertise, and your passion for this issue, and for taking the time to educate all of us about this critical issue in American history, and in particular in South LA history, at a time when more needs to be done to defend the rights of people to have, as Rabia put it, affordable and healthy housing. Thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in. South LA Rooted couldn't be here without you. And we will make sure that we share the links to not only the organizations represented here on this panel, but also the resources they shared with us here today. Thank you very much for joining us. Have a great rest of your day.
This podcast is made possible by the generous investments of the California Endowment. The content is taken from the South LA Rooted Report, which is written by Laura Murata and Eric Watt in collaboration with Special Service for Groups Incorporated.
The show is produced at the Hood Digest Digilab. It's narrated by Marlo J. and Elmer Roldan. The theme music features original content from South Central Cartel's South Central Madness and original music produced by Rico Pavón. The podcast is produced by Daniel Castillo and Brian Aguilar. Our assistant producer is Nelly Arciniega.
Subscribe, share, comment, and like the South LA Rooted podcast on all platforms.